Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And top of the morning or afternoon, as the case may be, or even evening if you're listening to us in Europe, to you. Tom Hartman here with you. Michael Dudley is the son of a preacher man, writes Haley Edwards in the Seattle Times, a staff reporter for the Seattle Times. The headline, Young Evangelical for Obama. He's a born-again Christian with two family members in the military. Grew up in the Bible Belt. Everyone he knew was a Republican. He plans to vote for Barack Obama. As Dudley, 20 years old, said, I think a lot of Christians are having trouble getting behind the what the Republicans stand for. And, you know, that's the bottom line. 15% of white evangelicals between 15 and 29, a group traditionally a shoo-in for the GOP, say they no longer identify with the Republican Party. Here come the millennials. Bob Herbert's piece. An important aspect of the presidential race so far has been the generational divide. Bob Herbert writing about this. This is a fascinating topic, and I'd like to dig into this a little bit. Roughly the late teens to the early 30s are the so-called millennial generation. He points out that in 1974, if you were 30 years old, if you were a man 30 years old making a living, the average income, the median income was $40,000. Now it's $35,000. And, you know, this is basically blowing folks up. It's, Kurt, we got everything under control. You can come back later. Now it's about $35,000. This brings us to a topic that I think is a really crucial one, and that is this issue of generational change. Franklin Roosevelt talked about how from some generations much is demanded, this generation, he said, has a rendezvous with destiny. There was a book written by William Strauss and Neil Howe back in 1996. It was called The Fourth Generation. Excuse me, The Fourth Turning, an American Prophecy. And in this book, now this was, keep in mind, this was written in 1995, 96. It was published in 97. In this book, they wrote, and I'm quoting from the book, the next fourth turning is due to begin shortly after the new millennium. So they were predicting basically now. Around the year 2005, a sudden spark will catalyze a crisis mood. Remnants of the old social order will disintegrate. Political and economic trust will implode. Real hardship will beset the land with severe distress that could involve questions of class, race, nation, and empire. And keep in mind, this was written conceivably as much as 15 years ago. Yet this time of trouble will bring seeds of social rebirth. The very survival of the nation will feel at stake. America will pass through a great gate in history, commensurate with the American Revolution, the Civil War, and the twin emergencies of the Great Depression and World War II. They also point out that this will be a time when the risk of catastrophe is very high. The nation could erupt into insurrection or civil violence, crack up geographically, or succumb to authoritarian rule. If there is a war, it will likely be one of maximum risk and efforts, in other words, a total war. In this book, what they did is they talked, Strauss and Howe talked about how there's basically these four generations of Americans that or of people. They track it actually all the way back to the 1600s in Great Britain. And that this cycle of four generations is continuously repeating itself. And that in the process of repeating itself, every fourth generation, which is about every 80 years, there's this major historical turning point. There are these four minor turnings and this one kind of major where it resets itself. And they talk about the generations, going back to King Arthur, from the Arthurian generation through today's millennial generation. There have been 24 generations in the Anglo-American lineage. This from their book, the Fourth Turning. The first six were purely English. The next four were colonial, And then came the 11th, in fact, was the Awakeners. They were born 1701 to 1723. These were the people who did the American Revolution, the first distinctively American generation. And basically what they say is that because you've got these four generations, and every 80 years you have a crisis. 80 years ago was World War II and the Great Depression, the Republican and Great Depression. 80 years before that was the Civil War. 80 years before that was the Revolutionary War. And it just goes back behind that. 80 years before the Revolutionary War was the New World area, the Glorious Revolution of 1675 in England. 80 years before that was the Armada Crisis, the Tudor time in 1569 to 1594. 80 years before that was the late medieval, the War of the Roses, 1459. I mean, it just keeps repeating itself because the generation that lives through the crisis then gives birth to a generation that are the quiet builders. And they, because of the nature of each one of these generations, that generation then gives birth to a generation that seeks spiritual insight and the Thoreaus, the Emersons, the Bob Dylans, that generation that questions authority. And then that generation gives birth to a generation that experiences much material gain, which is largely the result of the hard work of the second of these four. But that third generation, you know, kind of the hippie generation, as it were, they give birth to the generation, what we're now calling the millennials, who will then experience again the great crisis. Well, who will go into, this is actually, the millennials will be the fourth one, that they give birth to this generation that is like all about, hey, we got a lot of money, let's spend the money, let's live in debt, let's play video games, let's, you know, the kind of slackers. And then that generation, through their wastrel ways, leads to the crisis and the Great Depression and the war. And there was, in fact, a Great Depression that preceded not just the World War II, but also that preceded the Civil War and that preceded the Revolutionary War and that preceded the War of the Roses and all the way back. And so what they're suggesting is that this cycle gets reset every 80 years and that it's in the process of getting reset right now. And I would submit to you that I think Bob Herbert is right, that the millennial generation are going to be the generation that bring about the Barack Obama phenomena, whether or not he's the nominee, whether or not he's the president. That this movement is underway and it's not going to change and it's not going to go away. The question is how much backlash is there going to be to it? And the question is, at what level does that genuine movement that really understands the issues interact with previous generations, earlier generations who are still alive, still participating and still voting, who maybe don't so well understand the issues in ways that are meaningful? For example, talking to Bernie Sanders last week, off the air, we were going to talk about this on the air and we just never got a chance to. And he made the point that we liberals may be making a mistake by just dismissing Hillary Clinton's suggestion for a gas holiday if it can be paid for with the windfall profits tax in the oil companies rather than throwing people out of work. You know, I mean, the downsides of it, because there are a lot of people out there who don't have the time, don't have the inclination, don't have the education, but mostly, frankly, don't have the time. They're not political junkies to really understand the details and depths of these kinds of issues. And yet what they do know is that they can't plan a vacation this year because the price of gas has wiped out their vacation budget. Or even worse, they can't buy medication or go visit the doctor because they can't afford the copays because the price of gas has wiped out their discretionary budget. Or even worse than that, they can't afford food because the price of gas. In some cases, they can't, you know, they're driving far enough to work that they can't even afford to work anymore. These people need some relief. They need it right now. So sitting around and saying, well, you know, the solution is for us to raise the CAFE standards so that 3 years from now, the car companies are all making cars that have higher gas. No. We need to have both. We need to obviously have the long-term stuff, to be thinking in terms of the long-term. That is you know, dealing with the things that this movement, that the politically wise elders, the people who are now in their the boomer generation, and the politically wise millennials, the people who are under 30, get. But that the people in the middle, the people from, say, 25 to 45, that generation, by and large tend to miss, in part because they're working so hard, in part because it's just that's that third generation in that cycle that Strauss and Howe identified, who tend not to be so politically active. So how do you appeal to them? How do you create a movement that appeals right across the board and that brings us through this fourth turning without creating a world war? What a question.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Strange stuff going on out there in the science world, by the way.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Yeah, the ghost chickens that are coming to get us. I'm telling you, how can a mammal have chicken genes and snake genes? It's just not possible, right? That a mammal could, I mean, you can't have two species of mammals, two different species of mammals mate with each other. How could a mammal mate with a bird or with a snake? But they found the platypus actually has, they just decoded its gene, its genome. And the platypus, classified as a mammal, because it has fur and feeds its young with milk. It has a beaver-like tail. It also has bird and reptile features, a duck-like bill and webbed feet. Turns out it has the genes of a bird that give it its bill. And it produces venom in its back feet with the genes of a snake. How could this be? Well, scientists are saying that the platypus branched off 165 million years ago before all of these three different kinds of animals had completely split apart. And so it carries some of the characteristics of all of them. I would say that it probably has to do with the pigeons and the planet Xenu and because somebody had to have a gene gun. You know, this is like right now, for example, the genetically modified corn that has this, the genetically modified foods in general that can carry these markers that cause them to fluoresce, you know, so you can identify them and things like that. You find starfish genes are now in our food products. And this is impossible. Well, what they do is they use a gene gun. It's like a gun that takes a little piece of starfish DNA and accelerates it fast enough that when they whack it against a cell, it penetrates the cell wall, it goes through the nucleus, it goes through the nucleolus, right into the DNA, and injects the DNA, that other species DNA, right in. It's literally called a gene gun. This thing was just invented in the last 30 years or so. So, but the platypus is, you know, kind of an old animal, so maybe when they first came to seed the planet from Xenu with the pigeon robots, they also were playing around with gene guns and they created the platypus. I don't know, one theory. Anyhow, the first turning is a high. These four generations, strengthening institutions, weakening individualism. This is from Strauss and Howe. The second turning is an awakening, an era of spiritual revival and upheaval. The third turning is unraveling, strengthening individualism and weakening institutions. This is the Reagan era. The fourth turning is a crisis. Secular upheaval, a values regimen, propels the replacement of the old civic order with a new one. And the values would be things like, we're all in this together. Progressive values. We're all in it together. The idea of a national health care program, the idea of unemployment, all the solid progressive values. Franklin Roosevelt talked about generation. I quoted him earlier. Here's the actual clip.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Now, Strauss and Howe are right. Roosevelt was actually speaking to a generation that literally did have a rendezvous with destiny in the 1930s. And that generation is back again. And that generation, by the way, had a rendezvous with destiny in the 1860s in the Civil War. It had a rendezvous with destiny in the 1780s, in the 1770s, 1780s in the Revolutionary War. It had a rendezvous with destiny in a series of events prior to that, every 80 years that went back to the War of the Roses in England. And it's here now again. So what sort of changes is this going to bring about? Strauss and Howe suggest it'll be a time of incredible crisis, a possible slip into authoritarianism, a possible slip into world war, because, or at least national war. And out of that will come a great transformation. It's sort of like what Ravi Batra writes about in his book, The New Golden Age. I mean, he's essentially saying the same thing, only from an economist's point of view. So how do we pull these folks together? I think one of the most interesting links that I saw this morning, you know, just browsing through the news sites, was on Drudge. There were a series of articles about how people who are going door-to-door for Obama are encountering vicious racism. I mean, just vicious, in-their-face racism as they knock on people's doors or as they're making phone calls. And how this has been really pumped up by the whole Reverend Wright thing that was trumpeted in the media for day after day after day after day, and by political campaigns as well. And how do we bring along those of us who are basically the boomer generation and the millennial generation who are the political activists, how to bring along the Gen X, Gen Y, the slacker generation, as it's referred to sometimes, or for that matter, the members of the boomer generation and the millennials who are still in that kind of racist mode, that divisive mode. How do we bring them all along? How do we bring America back together? And is something like what has been characterized as a stunt, Hillary Clinton's suggestion of a gas tax holiday, is that something that actually would work? I'm inclined to think so, that we need short-term solutions as well as long-term solutions. We need things that are obviously and overtly political as well as clearly and strongly structural. Make it all happen together. Take your calls on this, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, working with Annette here every day, doing live talk radio. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, our program brought to you in part by Teamsters for a Change. It's time for a change in Washington, D.C. Teamster.org is the website, and proudly sponsored by the Teamsters. Here's how it works. The millennial generation, this era could be called the millennial crisis. And this, again, let me refer you to this book, The Fourth Turning, which has been out for over a decade, and it's still a brilliant piece by Strauss and Howe. They've written several books since then and before then, actually, The Generations of America and whatnot. This is my favorite of their books. The millennial generation, born after 1982, this period of time would be called the millennial crisis. The 13th generation, the previous generation, the culture wars. See, each generation has its own archetype, and there are these four archetypes. So the millennial generation will be the hero, the same as the GI generation, those who were born 1901 to 1924, who experienced the Great Depression of World War II. The same as this hero The same as arguably the Republican generation, 1742 to 1776, their birth time. Their main hero was Thomas Jefferson, who experienced the American Revolution. And it goes, you know, going backwards, this generation has hero. Then the generation before that, the 13th generation, their archetype is the nomad. That is, you know, it's sort of like going within. And it's very libertarian, actually, this whole nomad. The generation before that, the boomers that Clinton was the spokesman for in the political realm, people born between 43 and 60, their archetype is the prophet. And the generation before, which is external, out in the world, the generation before that, the silent generation, born 1925 to 1942, their archetype is the artist. And again, the artist is within, the prophet is without, the nomad is within, the hero is without. So you have every other generation, a group that goes out and gets active, and every other generation, a group that goes in and goes internal. And it's not about good and bad, and it's not about, gee, they're activists and they're not activists. It's the way that they view themselves and how it all works. I just find it fascinating. We are at this absolutely pivotal moment in history, in the history of the United States. And we're seeing this played out right in front of our eyes. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Brian in Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
This concept of generations really fascinates me. I've read a couple of Strauss and Howe's books, and I think it's very interesting how, if you, like, for example, in the 20th century, if you go back two generations before the great generation that fought in World War II, you have the Gilded generation that lived through the turn of the last century, and they're very similar to the baby boomers.
That's right.
And then the generation after that was the lost generation of, you know, the 20s and F. Scott Fitzgerald, and they're very similar to the Gen Xers. And then you have, of course, the great generation, which is like the millennials. Well, the only thing I would add is it doesn't seem that each generation is the parent of the next generation. They're the parents of the generation, the two generations later.
Yeah,
so
right.
There was a generation between the great generation that fought in World War II and the baby boomers who they parented, and that would be the silent generation that you spoke.
Yeah, it's almost like the introspective generation. Whoa, sorry about that, Brian. But it's almost like the introspective generation is the parent to the next introspective generation, and the extrospective, if there is such a word, generation, the activist generation, is the parent to the next activist generation, and the activists alternate between prophet and hero, you know, between the ones who are speaking out and the ones who are fighting the wars. And the introverts, as it were, it's a very, very imprecise use of language, alternate between nomad and artist. It's just absolutely fascinating. Shelby in New York City. Hey, Shelby, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I always listen to your show, and every time I do, I learned some wonderful things.
Well, thank you.
First of all, I was born in 74. What generation do I fall in?
You were born in what year?
74.
74 would make you a 13th generation. That's 1961 to 1981, which is sometimes broken out as Generation X, Generation Y. The boomers ended in 1960, and the millennials began in 82.
Okay. Where my question comes in, hopefully you can provide some insight on it, is that I always often dialogue with some of my college friends, and we always talk about the fact that, and we laugh about it, that our parents' generation, who of course were born in the 1945 and up to 1960, that we call them the greedy generation because we feel like, you know, for example, I grew up on Long Island, and my parents bought their house for like $20,000 back in the 70s. Right. Now houses are going for like $650,000, which we just think is, you know, absurd, because seems the fact that we can't even afford that.
Yeah.
You know, coming into the economy that we have now.
Right. And if I may interrupt, your generation is, the archetype of your generation is the nomad. And so it would be, you know, which is the, you know, kind of a libertarian perspective, we're looking out for ourselves, we're creating tribe, we're going off, we're looking, you know, so it would be reasonable that generation would look at the previous generation, the prophet generation, and say, you know, hey, those people were just interested in navel gazing, you know, they were all about themselves, they were the greedy generation. And it makes sense that the 13th generation would view the boomers as the greedy generation. Or the GIs would view the lost generation would view the missionary generation, you know, going back to the World War I, World War II, as the greedy generation. yeah.
Even though I do look at the fact that, you know, our, my parents' generation were the ones who fought for civil rights and, you know, went up against the Vietnam War and things of that nature. But I often think that although they fought for that and, you know, made an attempt to provide us with a better life, they didn't prepare us for what could happen next. So now, I mean, if for me, looking at this political, you know, this election, I want to speak out and I want to get involved because I'm like, I am so tired of being taken advantage of. You know what I mean? Like,
and that's where it sweeps right across all the generations. And that's what happens when all the generations get energized and say, enough already. That's when you have these major turnings, these every 80-year turnings. And that's what happened in the 30s. That's what happened in the 1860s. It's what happened in the 1780s. And frankly, I think that that's what's happening right now.
So as you continue talking, can you provide, you know, my generation with some insight in terms of what we can do and how we should get involved to make some changes? Because I feel like half of us are sitting back and really not doing anything and thinking of, you know, becoming, you know, superstars to get rich, while the other half is really trying to make some moves to really change the country.
Yeah.
Can you provide us with some insight on that?
Well, I think, broadly, it's the stuff that is what makes politics work, and that is get involved, show up, get active. It's not enough to just vote. And the problem for your generation is that your generation right now is of the age where most of you are working your butts off just to make it through, just to make a living. And the consequence of these four cycles, and Ravi Bhatra talks about these in economic terms, I'm talking about them in sociological terms, but the consequence of these four cycles is that this will be the tough time. Right. And so it's going to be the tough time for the people who are of working age, who are, you know, between 20 and 40, 20 and 50, something like that, who are trying to make a living. And so getting involved in politics is even more of a challenge. But it's something that just has to be. It has to be if we're going to produce that kind of change. It's that your generation has to be there with my generation and with my children's generation, my youngest children's generation. Our oldest is of your generation. And we all need to be moving forward on this thing. And so, Shelby, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, John in Camas, Washington on KTPK. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just a couple things real quick. Love this subject. You know, we almost need to hear those words. I was driving my granddaughter to school. When you listen to Roosevelt, I mean, it brings goosebumps. Really, really big time. We almost need to hear those weekly. I mean, we just don't have people that talk like that today. It's just absolutely amazing. And you know,
well, did you hear yesterday Barack Obama talking about the race and all this? He was in West Virginia and he said, "I wish I had the words in front of me," because he said, a lot of people are going to support me. A lot more are going to support Senator Clinton. But he said, ultimately, what's going to bring us together is. And he talked in this eloquent phrase about our love for this country and how and its ideals. I mean, it was brilliant.
I certainly in no way meant to dismiss Obama because I think that he is absolutely fantastic and he's about as close as I'm probably going to ever hear in my lifetime to a person like Roosevelt. And I swear, in future years, we're going to look back on these times and say this is truly a great man.
Yeah, I agree.
It's unbelievable. Hey, one other thing, Tom. I look at Bush is fighting this war on terrorism. And what's going on right now with us and gas price and economy in our country? We have economic terrorism going on right now. Why doesn't he fight that war and help out the middle guy like you were talking about?
Because that economic destruction is being brought about by deregulation, and the deregulation that is allowing the commodity markets to become the next big area of speculation. You're seeing, you know, Enron economics, and, you know, Bush and his buddies are benefiting from that. Franklin Roosevelt, by the way.
I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
And we're moving in that direction again. Here we are, the fourth turning, 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Here's another song down memory lane with GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. They are saying that I knew and that I lied to you. But I'm not the only one hiding smoking guns. We blow smoke in your eyes.
See, here's the personification of the greedy side of the boomer generation.
But that's because you get news from your TV and they cover up for me. Towers fell, 'cause we pay them really well to blow smoke in your eyes.
Yes, well, enough of that, George. Thank you very much. 9 minutes before the hour. And this, you know, times like this are times that are not without peril. I mean, the last time that we entered into a fourth turning and that we were solidly in it, Franklin Roosevelt was elected president. And what happened? The reactionary forces, conservatives, in some of them in government, most of them in business, got together and they invited General Smedley Butler, who was at the time America's most famous war hero, Marine general. They invited General Smedley Butler, asked him to help overthrow, to do a coup d'etat, to overthrow President Roosevelt. Well, here's Smedley Butler himself testifying before Congress.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities, which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan is out.
Now, it's a fascist dictatorship right here in the United States is what he's talking about. He continues.
The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans to use as a bluff or as a club, at least, to intimidate the government and break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee.
He, 500,000 men, literally take over all the functions of government. I mean, this was a literal coup d'etat in place.
My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institutions. I want to retain the right to vote. I have the right to speak freely and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe.
And he blew the whistle on it. And when it got to the point of naming names, he named some names. The problem was, and Franklin Roosevelt frankly saw this, was that these were such high and powerful people that this could have just ripped apart the fabric of America. And so they basically walked away from any kind of prosecution. Bobby Kennedy looked at this situation. He, from, you know, two generations ago, looking prophet generation as opposed to the hero generation that's coming out now, looking at this and saying, you know, we have to change this. And I'll play that clip a little later on in the program. Right now, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And JC in L.A. Hey, JC, what's up?
Hello?
You're on the air.
Oh, fantastic. I love your show. I just wanted to make the point that I'm part of, I guess, what you would call the Gen X, the slacker generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem with my generation is that, you know, we heard about our parents' generation fighting for civil rights and doing all that, and then they all became Reaganites, you know, and
yep.
So it's sort of like, what's the point? You know, me and my friends, it's like we're all Democrats and we all go vote for whoever the Democratic candidate is, but we kind of all in our hearts feel like nothing's going to change. You know, we all voted for Clinton and then, you know, he kind of let us down. And so
yeah.
I think that's the problem with my generation.
An interesting analysis, JC. Thank you. And Clinton, in fact, did let us down. I mean, you know, he ran as a progressive and he governed as basically an old fashioned Republican. But I think that the times are changing. I really do. I think that the times are changing. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich.
Hello, Tom. The times are changing is a good intro to my call because I wanted to talk about really the influence of the 1960s that it continues to have on America. And I think one of the things the 60s spawned was this intense bipartisanship. You know, it seems like the last several elections we continue to fight the Vietnam War. And And I think that's one of the attractive things about Barack Obama is he is post-Vietnam.
Yeah.
And he's going against a guy whose identity is deeply rooted in the Vietnam era. It reminds me very much of when Clinton beat Dole.
A better analogy is Roosevelt versus Hoover, because you had the same thing in the early 20s. In the early 20s, there was this very, very strong movement against the use of alcohol. I mean, you had the flappers, and you had the roaring 20s, and then you had the backlash, and you had prohibition, and then you had the end of prohibition. And that was a social upheaval, a time of social upheaval, and then the squashing of social upheaval, or the resolution of it, as it were, that was not that different from the 60s going into the 70s.
Right, and I guess the reason I think of Dole is it seemed like that election was a passing of the guard from the World War II generation to the Vietnam era generation, and the Republicans didn't get it.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't get it in time. And I think maybe they're making the same mistake this election, that maybe we're all ready for another generation of leadership, and they don't recognize it. And I hope that's right. Thanks,
yeah.
Tom.
Thank you. Thank you, Rich. I think you are right. Marcy in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Marcy.
Hi, the woman previous kind of said what I was going to say, except that I need to expand on it a little bit. I think that our generation has another factor that's kind of made up our lack of involvement in politics, and I think it's disillusionment, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, began, well, I think began with Vietnam, and then there was the hope of the hippie generation, but then there was Watergate and the Contract on America, and then the Republicans, what they did with Monica Lewinsky, and then topped off by this Bush regime. And I think it's just kind of left people with a sense of powerlessness.
That's
which
right.
We cannot have.
And we have to recover our power as Americans. We have
right.
to, you know, just, you know, sort of like Smedley Butler, we have to say, we're bringing this back. We're going to bring back America. And the way to do it, obviously, is to get involved in the political process. As I said, it's not enough to just vote. We have
right.
to get involved.
You know, and people too often, even, you know, educated people, non-educated, they just think they really have no say in the process, and I think they're wrong. We just have
yeah.
to have a little faith.
They are wrong. Marcy, thank you very much. Well said. Coming up in our next hour, Mark Morano is going to be with us. Is God punishing him and James Inhofe by killing people with tornadoes in Oklahoma? And in our third hour, Arthur C. Clarke is going to come and tell us that conservatives are happier than liberals. He's got a new book about it. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative
con.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. As the Guardian, the newspaper in the UK, is reporting, and increasingly being reported across the United States, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, this is the official U.S. government agency on their website, has confirmed that the average growth of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere right now for the year 2007 was 2.14 parts per million, a little over 2 parts per million per year. Prior to the year 2000, it was averaging only 1.5 part per million per year. Mark Morano is with us. Mark is the communications director for Senator Inhofe's staff, the Senate Environment and Works Public Works Committee, epw.senate.gov. And, Mark, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Is God going to continue punishing you and Senator Inhofe and the poor people of Pitcher, Oklahoma, with these tornadoes because you keep denying that the global warming is causing this problem?
Well, I hope you're joking, right?
Well, sort of. I mean, you know, Mr. Hagee, your Republican presidential nominee's guy, says that that's what's going on, and I'm assuming that you don't go along with John McCain's choice of spiritual.
I have not heard that. You're saying that they're linking the tornadoes because, from what I understand about all this, the science of tornadoes and global warming, there's actually no linkage or a very weak linkage, and actually Al Gore in his film basically used better detection of tornadoes to claim that they were increasing. I mean, now we can detect micro tornado that we never would have known about existed.
Well, what Mr. Hagee said is that basically these are acts of God and that these are visited upon people for punishment and in all cases. And so here we have the poor town of Pitcher, Oklahoma. Seven people were killed a couple of days ago. And, you know.
I'm not familiar, so I'll give you the classic no comment on that. I'm not aware.
Well, then let's get to some science here. James Hansen, the chief climatologist for NASA, wrote a paper, was published 2 weeks ago. I'm sure you're quite familiar with this. He said, if humanity wishes to preserve a planet similar to that upon which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted, paleoclimatological evidence and ongoing climate change suggest that CO2 will need to be reduced from its current 385 parts per million to at most 350 parts per million. This is let's take it back down to 350 parts per million, and it was far below that back before the Industrial Revolution started.
Well, what I would say to James Hansen is, whether he's right or wrong, eventually, as technology improves, we're going to move on to other forms of energy, number one. Number two, any attempts to try to solve this so-called quote-unquote problem are only going to make people poorer and empower governments and cause more regulation and ultimately fail. I mean, if you
Why does the development of wind power and solar power make people poorer, Mark? I don't get this.
It's the way you go about it. I mean, in fact, the Wall Street Journal had a great analysis in terms of units per energy. The U.S. government is subsidizing alternative, cleaner energy much more than they are oil and gas energy in terms of the output produced. So the point here is, how do you go about
it? Wait a second. The $18 billion went to the oil companies in U.S. subsidies last year, and it was less than $500 million went to alternatives. I think it was $200 million. You probably know the exact numbers.
And it comes out to cents on the gallon in terms of federal subsidies, given the amount of power that oil and gas generate.
Mark, isn't this
a
case of, you know, figures can lie and liars can figure? I mean, not that I'm calling you a liar, but come on.
No, it's just about results. But back to James Hansen. I mean, he is essentially saying that a trace gas in the atmosphere that's more linked to ocean circulation and ocean heat content than it is to global temperatures is going to essentially end civilization on Earth. James Hansen is essentially with Al Gore on this. He has been now, even mainstream reporters of the New York Times don't even quote James Hansen. He's out on a limb on this.
No, James Hansen is the chief climatologist for NASA.
He's
with Al Gore. Al Gore won a Nobel Prize for this. Al Gore is his position is the official science position of the official scientific body of the United Nations, the IPCC.
Hansen is literally a political activist who makes comical claims of censorship that we should all pause and make, you know, hearty laughs about.
A political activist within the Bush administration?
Yeah, well, he's not appointed by Bush. He's served, I believe, at least since the first Bush, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even under Reagan.
Right, because he's a good, solid scientist.
No, he makes claims about Greenland that aren't supported in peer review. He is off the reservation to many scientists. And actually, it's not that difficult to find many scientists who have significantly distanced themselves from James.
The NOAA on their website today, I mean, this just last couple of days came out. You can NOAA.gov, I believe, is their website, confirming that carbon dioxide is accumulating faster than expected. I'm sure you've seen this. What are you gonna, you know? I mean, you say, well, you know, we're gonna solve this problem. Eventually, we're gonna have changes. But you know, Bush is saying that he doesn't even want to see a change begin until 2025. Now, John McCain is talking about 2050. You know, let's solve this problem by then.
All anyone talks about are models of how they're going to reduce future CO2. It's not reality. Look what's happening just in London. They just bounced out Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London, who was a big advocate of this. The bottom line is Europe is finding out. It's a lot easier.
They probably bounced him out because he charged a tax to drive around in downtown London.
No, you don't seriously
think that Ken Livingstone not getting elected in London had anything to do with global climate change?
In terms of environmental green taxes, absolutely. In terms of the linkage, I mean, it's a harbinger. It's not necessarily the only – obviously, any election is local and has a whole bunch of issues. But there's clearly a backlash going on. The U.S. has not had a backlash because we've, so far, up to this point, avoided – these kind of regulations.
So in Denmark, where in Denmark where they're generating 19-20% of their electricity with wind power, this is a backlash. And in fact, you know, yesterday John McCain was here in Oregon with our Democratic governor Ted Kulongoski at a windmill farm talking about the wonders of wind power, and it was a Danish company actually. I mean, you've got companies all over the world. British Petroleum is now the largest manufacturer and distributor of solar cells in the United States, a British oil company.
Well, that doesn't mean it's. But why are you acting as though the federal government is the only way? I mean, if there's a market.
Because we have a crisis right now. We need a Manhattan Project.
There is no. That's the point. There is no crisis. We just had the new peer-reviewed study come out of the journal Nature saying global warming may take a break for up to two decades at this point, and we're facing 2030.
And then roar back with an absolute screaming vengeance because what we're looking at is the La Nina El Nino oscillations.
And then a bunch of scary computer model predictions which can't forecast backwards. This whole movement, the scientists keep coming out of the woodwork. Peer-reviewed studies keep debunking this over and over.
Mark, the coral is being bleached. The oceans are warming. The forests are dying off. The deserts are moving. The glaciers are melting.
Listen to NPR. Oceans have actually slightly cooled in recent years. It's baffling all these global warming advocates and scientists who spent years entrenched in activism. They're trying to figure out why the oceans have slightly cooled. They're trying to figure out why the globe hasn't warmed since 90.
Has Senator Inhofe had a conversation with John McCain recently?
What's that?
Have you guys had any conversations with John McCain? I mean, he's out there. Here's your Republican presidential nominee. Presumptive nominee, nobody's doubting it. He's out there saying, A, I believe that there's a crisis and we need to do something, and B, even if there's no crisis at all, isn't it crazy that we're importing 60% of our oil? 60% of the oil that's coming to the United States is by and large coming from countries that are not exactly our friends. Regardless of your political persuasion, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Hugo Chavez, you know, people that maybe we shouldn't be sending all this money to.
Well, maybe that's why we should be drilling in Anwar. We should be drilling off the coast of the U.S.
Maybe it's why we should be building solar cells. We should be putting them on the roof of every house like Germany does.
Absolutely. I mean, again, you're confusing and conflating these two issues here. Senator Inhofe is a big supporter of geothermal energy in Oklahoma. All kinds of alternative energy are in the mix. And we've even supported biofuel mandates, not as restrictive as we currently have. But the point of this is it's not a crisis. There's nothing that has to act. Government, if you look at the Lieberman-Warner bill, the biggest one on the table, they're talking about even Friends of the Earth is condemning it because it's going to be $1 trillion in pork flowing back to Washington. And you know that's not going to do anything for the climate. It's going to be going into the best whale-heeled lobbyists, the best industries. They're going to play the market.
Certainly our system is corrupt, Mark, and we need, you know, public campaign finance. I mean, but here we have, I mean, you look at these observations at Mauna Loa from 375 parts per million in 2004 up to 385 parts per million now. I mean, this is a crisis. We're seeing a dramatic increase in carbon dioxide in our atmosphere.
Right, but without any dramatic increases in temperature. If anything, temperature's cooled, and it's going to continue to cool. So right there on the face of it, that's not working. The temperature's... Again, as we've gone through this, and you talk to Ivy League geologist Robert Kiegengack, temperature, warmth leads CO2 levels, and that's
yeah. And as I said, I see your 200 skeptics, and I raise you the 2,000 at the IPCC. But Mark Morano, Mark, good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day,
5 days a week.
You gave them an act with...
Global warming is an issue that my administration is very concerned about, deeply. Deeply, in a deep kind of concerned way. It's, I start my day and I think about the warming of the globe and how we can get it warmer.
Cut.
You played them both right to perfection. Despite the fact there's no
connection. You razzle dazzle them. Let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah, yeah. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, just a heads up, I'll be at Frugal Muse Books at 7 o'clock on Friday night. This is at the corner of southeast corner of 75th and Lamont Road, or Lamont, L-E-M-O-N-T, Lamont Road, probably, in Darien, for our listeners in Chicago. And waving your arms around here. And also on the 17th, we'll be at the Chicago Green Festival. I'll be speaking from the main stage there. And keynoting that conference, so that should be a lot of fun. McCain's corporate tax cut. This, the headline, McCain's corporate tax cut would save energy and utility companies over $2.8 billion. Yes, a global warming plan, as thinkprogress.org analyzes, a global warming plan that weans America off dirty energy requires taking a stand against the huge utility and energy companies, but John McCain's tax plan seems slightly more interested in lining their pockets. The Center for American Progress Action Fund did an analysis of John McCain's massive corporate tax cut that he says is part of his global energy, global warming, is going to save America's 10 largest electrical utility companies and 10 largest energy companies over $2.8 billion. This in addition to the $4 billion tax break for America's five largest oil companies. It's all quite quite mind-boggling. You add it all together. James Hansen, once again, the chief climatologist at NASA, he has said that there are five tipping points that we're approaching. And very significant tipping points that we need to be concerned about. Number one is the carbon dioxide tipping point. He says anything above 350 parts per million, we're facing a very serious problem. Number two, the ice tipping point. The ice reflects 80% of sunlight. When it's replaced by water or by permafrost, it absorbs 80% of the sunlight. And, you know, it just goes right down through the list. I would refer you to Bill McKibben's piece in the Los Angeles Times. It was also published at commondreams.org a couple of days ago. And it's titled Civilization's Last Chance. And really well worth looking at, that carbon dioxide is leaping forward, and this is an issue of considerable concern. I think that this also plays into the issue that we talked about in the previous hour about the generations of America and about the activism that is necessary, and how every 80 years there's this giant crisis that a generation confronts, and I think that this is a part of it. Bobby Kennedy talked about this. In a speech before he died, it was on Gross National Product on GNP. This is Robert Kennedy.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community value in the mere accumulation of material things.
Yeah, the accumulation of stuff. We're giving up personal excellence to this and national excellence.
Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertisements and ambulances to clear our highway of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them.
His point that all economic activity is not necessarily good.
It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifles and Specs knives and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children.
And so this, all these incredibly destructive things that GDP includes, and it doesn't include the things that are really meaningful.
Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short. except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
This is the, it reminds me very much of the Adbusters ad some couple of years ago from adbusters.org, where they said, you know, for every forest that falls, GDP goes up. Every oil spill, GDP goes up. Every cancer diagnosis, GDP goes up. And then they end the ad by saying, if we are to survive, economists must learn to subtract. It's like GDP is the only measurement, or GNP as it used to be called? No. There are things that are so much more important. And we are awakening to that in America right now. I think it's an absolutely marvelous thing right across the board. 866-303-2270, our number. Your call's up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Wouldn't that be a fine thing? 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, our local radio stations. Let them know you're listening. Thank them for the show. Thank if you like it. If you don't, let them know whatever you're thinking. And by all means, support our sponsors, and including our national sponsors like the Teamsters. Teamsters for a Change. Time for a Change in Washington. Teamster.org is their website. Teamsters, one of the great, historically great unions in the United States. Some strange stuff going on over at the GOP. Yeah, the Republicans wanted to tie into the whole Democratic change meme. You know, they're saying, hey, this is a pretty powerful thought virus, as it were. And so they started pushing a new message, change you deserve. In fact, the House Republicans said, through our change you deserve message, House Republicans will continue our efforts to speak directly to an American public looking for leaders. The only problem? Change you deserve is a registered advertising slogan of Effexor XR. Effexor is one of the, also known as Van Lefadexing, however you say it, is one of these SSRI drugs like Prozac. Yeah, well, Republicans, Effexor or Prozac or whatever, I suppose there probably is a correlation there. By the way, we're going to do a contest again today. Today we're going to give away a copy of my new book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. And the way you can enter that is by going over to TomHartman.com and on the blog on our homepage, on today's show's blog. And that, and you can click, you know, add comments or read more. And Sean Taylor, our producer, is going to, in the last segment of the day, tell us who she thinks posted the most, in her opinion, her favorite blog post. It might be because it's the smartest. It might be because it's the funniest. It might be because it's the silliest. It might be because it's the dumbest. I don't know. It's entirely up to Sean, whatever it may be. And she's going to pick one, and she'll let us know, and that person will receive an autographed copy of the hardcover edition of Cracking the Code, my newest book, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Jake in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? You know, this whole issue of conservatives supposedly being more happy than liberals?
Yeah, we're going to talk about it the next hour, actually.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the whole issue of the media we consume. You know, a generation ago, liberals and conservatives basically watched the same media sources. These days, you know, liberals listen to Tom Hartman and conservatives listen to Rush Limbaugh. You know,
could be. And the Limbaughs of the world are saying, don't worry, be happy. And the Tom Hartmans of the world are saying, hey, get out there, get active. And there's a satisfaction, dissatisfaction. Could be. And Jake, we'll cover that at some greater length. In fact, at length in the next hour of the program. But thanks for the call. Sandra in Oakland. Hey, Sandra. No, Sandra. Okay. Jake in Florida, listening on Wins. Hey, Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Hi, Tom. It's Jake. Jake? I just lost Jake. Okay. It's just a bad phone line. All righty. Let's try Chris in Long Island. Hey, Chris. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you? Good afternoon. Hey, Tom, and speaking about
I just lost Chris, too. So apparently we have a problem with our board and our telephone system. We're going to try this one more time just to see what happens. Dave in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Actually, I'm going to put this on the other side of the board, Chris. Let's see if we can hold this on the other side. Dave in Grand Rapids. Hey, Dave. You're on the air. Potted up on the right side of the board. I got nothing. Okay, we're going to have to get an engineer in here and figure this thing out. So back to global warming myths and facts. There's basically the bottom line. There is no debate among scientists, among serious scientists, serious climate scientists, about the basic facts of global warming. Right across the board, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, for example, which in 2005, the White House says, is the gold standard of objective scientific assessment. They issued a joint statement with 10 other National Academies of Science. This is the U.S. National Academy of Science, 10 other National Academies of Science, 10 other nations around the world saying, and this is a verbatim quote from the Joint Statement of Science Academies. Quote, the scientific understanding of climate change is now sufficiently clear to justify nations taking prompt action. It is vital that all nations identify cost-effective steps they can take now to contribute to substantial and long-term reduction in net global greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, that's the absolute bottom line. The only debate really that's going on is how fast this is happening, how severe it's going to be, what the exact consequences are going to be, and how natural variations and oscillations changing things like sunspot cycles variations in human activity and all those kind of things, how those might affect it. So, you know, bottom line, global warming is, at least global climate change is real. Global warming is one of the things that is driving it, and it will affect us. It is affecting us. So this is just, you know, the deepest bottom line. We're gonna take a break here and reset our phone lines during it so we can pick up your calls on the other side of it and to try and make all this work. You'd think Mercury is retrograde, but I don't think that happens until later on in the month. And, you know, fortunately, they'll be hopping on a plane here on Thursday. We'll be in Chicago on Friday over at Frugal Muse Books at 7 o'clock Friday night. If you're listening in Chicago, be sure and check that out. That should be great fun. And, of course, the Chicago Green Festival on Saturday. 40 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Let's try this one more time. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number, tomhartman.com, our website, airamerica.com, of course, for all things Air America. Dale in Florida, listening on Winds. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to tell you my experience with the environment. They say the world's not warming up and all that, but I'll tell you, from growing up down here and the beaches, no more shells on the beaches. They don't live anymore. They don't come up on the beaches. We'd have a... Mm-hmm. From here to North Carolina, we'd go up North Carolina and spend the summers and down here. And I'd always ever tell everybody, you got to go see it because when you get bigger, it's going to be gone. Mm. And we'd have these crabs that were like on the beaches, and they would dig down in the sand. They were dead by the time I was probably 10 or so. Yeah. Now, on the West Coast, they were smaller, about the size of a hummingbird egg, and they were there to about the 70s or so, and they're gone. And just diving on the water and everything between what is living and what's not there anymore with the sawgrass, with the fertilizers that come down the sawgrass, from the Everglades. It pours into the Everglades down there. It would change the feeding habits. And when we were kids, we could go canoeing on these 20-mile canoeing trips, and you would come onto the little lakes, and the ducks would be so solid, it would be like canoeing through a buffalo herd. And they would have to just separate for you to get through it. And when they take off, they would block out the sun, and you would swear you were in Africa. You go there today, you don't see it. The algae has come in, the plume of algae, and that consequently is going out and getting on our reefs and growing in all the grass and changing that. Yeah. Now, when we go to North Carolina, if you go along the Blue Ridge Parkway, all your balsams are dead. All the balsams, they're beautiful, big, shiny trunk trees that are dead, and North Carolina has more species of hardwoods than anywhere in the world. But all of them are in danger all the way down to your dogwoods. And I usually talk to the little kids, and I say, where are the big trees at? And they'll always say it's the redwoods and the sequoias. And I say it's not true, because the East Coast used to have all the big trees, but they harvested them all.
Yeah.
And there's a little section that's southwest of the Smokies that's called Joyce Kilmer Memorial Forest. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't been there in maybe 10 or 15 years, and I said, I had to go back to see this. And it's an unknown kind of little park. Kind of hard to find. And when you go there, you park, and there's maybe a little area about 50 acres or something in the bottom there. And it takes you about an hour to walk around. But you need four or five people to stretch your arms out to get around these trees.
Yeah.
They're just monsters.
This is what the original virgin forests were like on the East Coast.
They're on the East Coast, and sure, and nobody
they're just
knows
not there anymore.
They all think it was on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And then eventually I walk up the woods there, because I hadn't been back in that part of the woods there much, and I go back up in there, and sure enough, you'd see a little rogue tree here and there that's huge. And then the sequoias and the redwoods and all that, the bark protects them from the fires, and this is a different type of tree. And you would find these huge trees like this with these holes that were burnt out inside of them, and you could literally walk inside them like a teepee and look up, and you can't see how far up in the tree it's been burnt, but that foot and a half of the tree bark all the way around is supplying this huge tree, and it's still living. And I thought, how nice it is to live in the woods for 500 years. I said, but they're all in danger now because they're all disappearing so quickly.
Yeah, you get the bark beetles, and you get the logging and everything else.
Yeah,
Dale, excellent point. And in fact, you know, the thing that I've noticed has vanished is the butterflies. I just, you know, as a kid, I remember, you know, growing up in Michigan, the butterflies every spring and summer the butterflies would come in, and there'd just be all these different kinds, and you could identify, oh, that's the tiger-tail swallow, and that's the monarch, and that's the, you know, and the butterflies. And now it's very rare that I see any butterflies going back to Michigan, here in Oregon, the years that we lived in Vermont, the years that we lived in New Hampshire, they just don't seem to be around anymore. Craig in Berkeley, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Craig.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, I know I shouldn't ask that, but it seems to me that the oil companies want you and me to put all our energy eggs in their corrupt, anti-democratic hydrocarbon power basket with, you know, complete disregard for security, safety, or health of America. You know, with alternative energies like solar and wind and stuff, we can sustain and recover from a power failure or attack, you know, much easier and faster, because things are decentralized. They always want to centralize things so they can control it.
Yeah, absolutely. They want to centralize things so that not only can they control it, but that they can profit from it. And that's why they're opposed to things like what Germany is doing, where, you know, every house, at least a third of the houses now, have solar energy, have solar panels on their roofs. And we absolutely need to be going with decentralized solutions, and we're not. And we're not because, you know, the Enrons of the world, the big power companies of the world, don't want there to be decentralized solutions. Alan in Irvine, California. Hey, Alan.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My thought was that because President or Vice President Cheney had come up with this idea of the 1% solution, which basically says that if we perceive a terrorist threat, we apply 100% against a 1% chance because the consequences are so dire. And my thinking was that if he believes that, then he ought to apply that to the global warming issue.
Mm-hmm. In other words, if there's a 1% chance that global warming is going to be a disaster, we should apply 100% of our efforts, because that's the formula that he uses for terrorism. Excellent one, Alan. Excellent. Yeah, well said. Lisa in Westminster. Hey, Lisa.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. I think one way to get people to cooperate in working for change is to not stereotype, whether it's by race or generation or anything else. In the last hour, I heard some stereotypes about Generation X. I've looked at some of those books you're talking about, and they tend to write off my generation, Generation X, as worthless and slackers and racist. And when you say things like that...
No, Lisa, they don't, actually. What they do is they point out that the archetypes and the heroes are different. They're not the external activists, they're the internal thinkers.
Well, they kind of imply that my generation is just not going to be very involved in change and don't count on us too much. And that one book, Generations, by Howe and Strauss in particular, it sounded like an attempt to pit generations against each other to distract from economic and class issues. And in fact, one of those guys, Howard Strauss, was part of that movement to so-called reform Social Security and Medicare by getting rid of them.
No,
and,
Lisa, I'm sorry. You really need to read the books before you critique them. I'm serious. These, you know, I'll just leave it at that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is on the line with our daily report on what's going on in the world. Hey, Ellen.
Well, first of all, let's start out with the world before we get into Washington, D.C. Part of the issue with Burma, Myanmar, is that they are, reading between the lines at the United Nations, which nobody said directly, but it looks as if they may be sort of trying to cover up for some other kind of crimes against humanity that the Burmese government committed, and that's part of the reason they don't want to really let any other workers in.
Now, here's something. This is really interesting. Back about when was the Rwandan genocide? Was that 94?
It was 94.
Yeah, 94. In 93, a guy by the name of Tim Wentz he's now a congressman. But he was a school teacher in Alliance, Nebraska, and he had his class look at social inequality in countries all around the world as a predictor of the probability of genocide. They went back and they looked at historic genocides, whether it was the Holocaust or the Armenian genocide. There's a whole bunch of them that they looked at, and they found that the major variable that always seemed to precede a genocide was a dramatic spread, a dramatic redistribution of wealth, where the rich became very, very rich, the poor became very poor, and the middle class largely vanished. And based on that, in 1993, Tim Wentz's high school geography class predicted that the next genocide would be in Rwanda. And they published this in the school paper, and then they all went off to vacation. And when they came back, the genocide in Rwanda happened, and they were horrified. Now, they also predicted that within the next 15 years, the genocide following the Rwandan genocide would be in Burma, in Myanmar. And so what you're saying right now is that it looks like the Myanmar government, the reason that they're not letting in aid workers is because they're trying to hide something from the rest of the world. I wonder if that high school class was right, if their prediction was right, and they certainly were right about Rwanda, if what this government is trying to hide is a genocide.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're definitely the sort of between the lines, again, and nobody said it directly at the United Nations, it's just sort of what we've been able to pick up, has to deal with the fact that there were certainly some extraordinary killings. How many people? Don't know. Hmm. But you're absolutely right, and that is why they think they don't want the aid workers in there.
Amazing. So it might be that it's been another Pol Pot kind of situation, which, by the way, the class also examined. Fascinating. What else is up?
Okay. In terms of Congress, the main thing, of course, that's going on today is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and that they're trying to get legislation through both in the House and Senate side to suspend deliveries into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Of course, the president is saying that he would absolutely veto that, no question. Also today, it looks like retail sales for the month dropped 0.2%. This is the second drop in 3 months. It also looks like the median prices for single-family homes have dropped in 100 of 149 areas that were surveyed, and there is a decrease in home prices, 7.7% from a year ago. That's significant. Whoa. when you're talking about you know, a couple hundred thousand dollar home.
I understand that more than 60% of Americans right now have as their net worth zero or a minus number. 60% of all Americans.
Wow.
And this, you know, as houses go, as what's referred to as upside down, as people take all the equity out of their homes, that number is increasing rather steeply.
A couple other interesting things going on. The GI Bill is going to be part of, as you know, these three Iraq votes that look like are happening in terms of the defense in terms of the defense bill, the extra money. And the issue is now the Defense Department is essentially saying, hey, look, we give too generous a package, we might have trouble keeping people in the military.
Yeah, well, and there's those who disagree with it, but they are hitting their recruiting goals, so we'll see what happens. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. So who's happier, and what does that mean? And what does that mean to all of us? I mean, what does that mean to society? Arthur Brooks is with us. He's the author of a new book. It's called Gross National Happiness, Why Happiness Matters for America and How We Can Get More of It. And his website, arthurbrooks.net. Arthur Brooks, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great to be back with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Your book, with a nice blurb from Newt Gingrich on the front cover, pretty clearly lays out the results of a number of studies. I've read the Pew study, I've looked through the studies in your book as well. You don't reference the Pew study so much in your book, but it came to very similar conclusions that in the United States, by and large, the happiest people are those people who have long-term stable marriages, reasonable income, they go to church regularly, and are Republicans.
Yeah, actually, it's the party itself doesn't make as much difference. What you find is that these sort of traditional values are what are driving a lot of the differences, and what we might think of as the happiness gap. Sort of demographics are half of it. And the other actually can be explained kind of by worldview with respect to how fair you think the world is, or how fair you think your country is, and how optimistic you are about the future. And the interesting things that a lot of these studies, including my book, or at least the very beginning of my book, comes to is that, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting for us, is that conservatives, as opposed to liberals, really think that hard work and perseverance have a much bigger payoff than liberals think that it does. And so the really interesting conversation, it seems to me, is about, you know, who's right? You know,
well, hang on just a second. That's the conclusion that you come to about how conservatives and liberals think. There, yeah. I couldn't find anything in your book that actually demonstrated that was the difference between conservatives and liberals. The historic difference between conservative and liberal thought, if you look at, for example, Sir Edmund Burke versus Thomas Paine, you know, the classic, the founder, Russell Kirk in his 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, that Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley cite as the foundational book of the modern conservative movement. His entire first chapter is based on Sir Edmund Burke. And Burke's big fight with Paine was that conservatism is accepting the status quo and not wanting to change it. And Paine's was that the essence of the liberal enlightenment and the enlightenment, that period in time, the 1600s, was referred to as the liberal enlightenment. You know, George Washington said, hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality, was change.
Yeah.
And so if you're happy with the status quo, you're by definition a conservative. And so really isn't there a dog chasing its tail here, a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, you know, I think that you've just described European conservatives better than American conservatives. And if you look a little bit later in the book, it's actually not in the politics chapter of my book, but a little bit later where I talk about income equality and income inequality. You find that about 90% of conservatives, if you ask them if hard work and perseverance pay off, they say, yes, it does. And only 65% of liberals agree with that. If you ask whether or not...
Well, those are still significant majorities.
What's that?
Those are still significant majorities.
Oh, well, it's a majority, but it's 25 to 30% percentage points different, and that's enough to really start driving some of these statistics. Particularly given the fact that you even find that poor conservatives are about 25 percentage points more likely than rich liberals to say that hard work and perseverance pay off. Now, that doesn't mean they're right. It just means that they actually think that more, are more likely to think that. And that, I think that drives the biggest part of the happiness gap.
Right. It's interesting to hear you put forth the argument of the critics of your book, which I didn't find in your book. Perhaps it's there. I can't say I read every word of it, but I spent a fair amount of time with it. But the critics of your book are essentially saying that well, in fact, in this thing that was published in Psychological Science, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with.
Oh yeah.
Our research suggests that inequality takes a greater psychological toll on liberals than on conservatives, and that conservatives have, again, this gets back to worldview. Conservatives have a worldview that says, hey, you know, there's rich and poor, and that's the way it is, and I got mine, and so screw them.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I think that actually is a spin that goes way, way, way beyond the data. I think that it is true that conservatives are more comfortable with inequality than liberals are. I think that's actually a sound conclusion from some of the.
But I mean, you're
studies.
Just looking at happiness. My friend Rob Calls made the comment yesterday. He says cannibals are happy after a good meal. Does that make it right?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, a lot of people, you know, George Bernard Shaw said better a pig or less a better, Socrates discontented than a pig contented or something along those lines.
Right. Well, the founding fathers were not happy people. I mean, they were willing to die for the ideals of this country.
Well, you know, but the whole idea somehow that this idea that if conservatives are more comfortable with inequality, that somehow that makes their morality, it brings it into question somehow. That's a big, big leap. And the reason is because, of course, we have to figure out why exactly conservatives are more comfortable with inequality in this country. And, you know, that's an important debate.
Well, let's look at the consequences of that comfort with inequality.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fascinating study that BBC reported on. You'll find this in the 18 September 2002 BBC website. You can easily Google it if you look at those dates. And the headline is More Suicides Under Conservative Rule. And this is a summary of three different studies that were done on two continents that over a 100-year period, they looking at statistics from New South Wales and Australia and in the UK and in Ireland from 1901 to 1998. And I'm just reading here from the BBC. Right? The scientists found the suicide rate in the country increased significantly when a conservative government was in power. An analysis of figures in the UK suggests a similar trend. The figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative state and federal governments were in power. Conversely, the lowest rates of suicide occurred when state and federal governments were both Labour. That would be liberal. When the conservatives ruled both state and federal governments, men were 17% more likely to commit suicide than when Labour was in power. Women were 40% more likely to kill themselves. Lead researcher Professor Richard Taylor told BBC News, "We think it may be because material conditions in lower socioeconomic groups may be relatively better under Labour because of government programs. There's a strong relationship between socioeconomic status and suicide." And then they went on to say in one of the series of accompanying editorials, the same patterns were evident in England and in Wales between 1901 and 2000. They concluded, overall, they say the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the conservatives not been in power. This is just based on suicide. This is the consequence of this kind of thinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, that once again, I mean, the whole idea of bringing I think it's pretty elliptical to bring the United States to say that if Republicans win power, conservatives win power, people are going to be blowing their brains out all over the place. I mean, I think this is just...
I'm guessing that if we did a similar meta-analysis in the United States, we would find that during the times when conservatives are in power and the middle class is diminished, as we've seen over the last 30 years, that suicides actually probably do go up.
But we also saw that inequality increased as much under Clinton as it has under other administrations.
Oh, I consider Bill Clinton to be a conservative.
But I don't think that we can actually say that somehow when Republicans are getting elected to Congress or Republicans are running the White House that somehow this is this big driver politically in inequality, not to mention the fact that...
Well, I would go back to your point that it's not about Republicans and Democrats because by my definitions, Dwight Eisenhower was a liberal and Bill Clinton was a conservative. And, I mean, when you look at the outcome of their policies, Dwight Eisenhower was in favor of a 91% income tax rate. He was in favor of strong labor unions. He was in favor of a whole lot of things that Bill Clinton, frankly, was opposed to. But here's the other thing. You know, you have to be familiar, I'm sure, with the University of Leicester, is it pronounced Leicester, study?
Yeah, sure.
This is a meta study of over 100 different studies around the world, questioning 80,000 people worldwide, and of who's happy and who's not. And what they found was that the happiest nation in the world was Denmark, followed by Switzerland, Austria, Iceland, the Bahamas, Finland, Sweden, Bhutan, Brunei, Canada. On down the list, the U.S. is number 23, and that the happiest nations tended to be those with the most liberal governments by the American use of the word, not the European use of the word.
Yeah, now before we actually call the moving company and go move to Denmark, here's one thing that'll throw a fly into the ointment, which is that the International Social Survey Program, which is conducted by the University of Chicago in the United States and equivalent universities around the world in 35 countries, about 35,000 people in the year 2002, came up with the conclusion the United States is significantly on average happier than Denmark or any of the other Nordic or Western European countries. It's actually just a little bit behind Mexico and Brazil in 2002, as it turns out. So,
right, that's the study that's in your book.
This is not gospel that Denmark is happiest, and this has been, all over the internet. And
so we have these dueling studies, basically. But
the
study of the University of Leicester suggested that the three predictor variables were health, wealth, and education, and people in countries with good health care, I'm quoting from their study, with good health care, a higher GDP per capita, and access to education were much more likely to report being happy.
Yeah,
doesn't that make sense? I mean, here you have objective data. Well, I'm sorry. Well, I missed our time cue. I thought we had another minute. Arthur, it's a great conversation. People can learn all about it at arthurbrooks.net. The book is Gross National Happiness. Thanks for dropping by and talking with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Anytime.
I appreciate it. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. TomHartman.com. By the way, Sean, at the end of this hour, is going to be looking at the best post there at TomHartman.com for a free copy of Cracking the Code. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Come heed me, good brothers, come hear one and all. Don't brag about standing, or you'll surely fall. You're shining your light, and shine it you should. But you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. No earthly good, you are no earthly good.
So are you happy?
You're so heavenly minded.
Are you a liberal or a conservative? Is it making you happy or unhappy? How do we even define happiness? I mean, if we're simply asking people, are you happy? Some people would translate that into, are you content? Are you pleased with the way things are? I mean, more than 70% of Americans say, America's going in the wrong direction. Does that mean that they would answer a question, are you happy, as are you happy with the way things are going? And, clearly those folks who are, doing well might say, yeah, sure, I'm very happy. In fact, interesting, the Pew study that was done on this that found, oddly enough, they said, of course, there's a more obvious explanation for the Republicans' happiness edge. Republicans tend to have more money than Democrats, and as we've already discovered, people who have more money tend to be happier. This from the Pew study that essentially comes to the same conclusions as Arthur Brooks does in his book. What they found is that people who earn under $30,000 a year, only 24% of them said that they were happy. People who earn $30,000 to $75,000, 33% of them in America said they were happy. People who earn $75,000 to $100,000, 38% of them said they were happy. And people who earn over $100,000 a year in the United States, 49% of them said that they were happy. Now, how might that change in other nations? We don't really know. This is one of those areas where so few studies have been done. It's like the suicide study in the UK and Australia. There's only been one really good study on this done. And it found this immediate causal relationship between conservative political policies and suicides. So, what's the relationship between happiness and income? What's the relationship between happiness and a national policy? If, for example, in Europe, where you already have, you don't have to worry about getting sick. If you get sick, that's, it's not going to force you into bankruptcy like it can in the United States. If you lose your job, it's not going to cause you to lose your home like it will in the United States. In those countries, the criteria for happiness might be very different than here in the United States, where our criteria is basically, you know, the baseline of safety and security. How much money a year does it take for a person to actually feel like they're safe and secure? And particularly given the political instability, the economic instability, the ongoing destruction of the dollar, the $9 trillion debt, every baby born in the United States right now is born with a $35,000 debt, $30,000 of that more or less, the result of three Republican presidents. I would say, yeah, I think anybody in America who is aware of these things would say, I don't know how you define happiness, but, you know, I may be happy in my relationships, I'm happy with my wife, I'm happy with my family, I'm happy with my community, but I'm not happy with the direction my country's going. And it's interesting, in many societies, this is certainly the essence of Aboriginal and Indigenous societies, but increasingly it's the essence of European society as well. In many societies, what people do all day long is they make safety and security. They do it by contributing to the society in a way that makes safety and security available to everybody through things like national health care programs and a national pension program, a good, strong equivalent of Social Security, unemployment insurance, a high enough minimum wage that people know that they can actually make a decent living. So people are contributing to safety and security all day long, and what they derive out of their society is safety and security. In the United States, by and large, the only way, particularly since Reagan, I mean, we had a brief period there where about 40 years, from the 1940s to the 1980s, where safety and security could be acquired simply by having a decent job. If you had a good job with a good union wage, you felt safe and you felt secure. And in fact, many of the people of that generation, you know, my dad, 40 years in a tool and die shop. When he died, his house was completely paid off. He'd raised four boys. He'd done very well. You could do that in America. Safety and security could be acquired with a job. Nowadays, safety and security isn't acquired with a job. Increasingly, jobs don't even provide the essence of security or of safety, for that matter, of things like health care. So how do we change that? How do we bring America to the European dream? Or is that desirable? Should we all simply become church-going Republicans and say, inequality, no big deal? We could have a world just like Charles Dickens did. We'll all aspire to be Scrooge rather than Bob Cratchit. But there's always going to be those among us who are discontented and who are saying, no, wait a minute. We can have a better country. See, that's what this country was founded on, was the malcontents, as they used to point out in the Apple ads. You know, the radical thinkers, the liberals who were saying, hey, wait a minute, we can make a better world. Let's do it. Let's make a better nation. Let's make a better country. Let's make a better world. Let's make a world where safety and security are a given. And then we can work on building the quality of our relationships and spiritual enlightenment and understanding and invention and transforming the world in positive and productive ways. How do we define happiness, after all? 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2278.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I have to share with you James Madison's thoughts on happiness and government. We'll pick up your phone calls. First, though, I wanted to tell you about some of the just truly crazy things going on in the world. First, this is how not to respond to a parking ticket. It's from the BBC. A man has sawn his car in half with an angle grinder in protest at it being clamped outside his home. Mr. Taylor bought the Fiesta for his stepson with the intention of restoring it. Spokesman for the NCP services, half the car was parked on the road and should therefore have been taxed. So he cut the car in half. Now, that wasn't as bad as the guy wearing a tuxedo in New York who took his lawnmower out for an early morning spin drunk. 1 a.m. Monday morning, police were called. They got a report of an intoxicated man. When they showed up, he was driving away on his lawnmower. They charged him with felony driving with intoxication and aggravated unlicensed operation of a lawnmower. Yeah, it's a felony because he had a previous DUI. Speaking of previous and foot and mouth disease and whatnot, the governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty, on WCCO AM, a local radio station in Breezy Point, Minnesota, he's talking about going fishing there, and he says, I have a wife who genuinely loves to fish. I mean, she'll take the lead and ask me to go fishing and joyfully comes here. She loves football. She'll go to hockey games, and I jokingly say, now if I could only get her to have sex with me. Governor, don't believe I would have said that. Baby, I'm crazy. I mean, sometimes, you know. Anyhow, here's what James Madison had to say about happiness. This is from Federalist number 45. The Federalist Papers, of course, the papers that James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, by and large, I think John Jay contributed a couple of them, but basically that they were writing to sell the Constitution between 1787 and 1789 when it was ratified. And he says, is it too early for politicians to presume on our forgetting that the public good, the real welfare of the great body of the people, is the supreme object to be pursued, and that no form of government whatever has any other value than as it may be fitted for the attainment of this object? Were the plan of the convention, in other words, he's talking about the Constitution, were the plan of the convention adverse to public happiness, my voice would be, reject the plan. Were the Union itself inconsistent with public happiness, my voice would be, abolish the Union. In like manner, as far as the sovereignty of the United States cannot be reconciled to the happiness of the people, the voice of every good citizen must be, let the former be sacrificed to the latter. In other words, the sovereignty of the nation itself should be surrendered if it doesn't make the people happy. Remember, our Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson wrote, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, was the first time in the history of the world that the word happiness was in the founding document of a nation. Pretty amazing stuff. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Charles in Brooktondale, New York. Hey, Charles.
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's the first time I ever called.
Well, thank you for calling. Thanks for listening to WNYY. What's up?
Yeah. Well, I saw or read something, it may have been in the New York Times, but it said that happiness, people are happier when they have fewer choices in their life.
The Robert Wolf, who wrote What It Means to Be Human, do you remember the new title of that? His book has been retitled, and it's out now. In any case, Robert Wolf is a very, very wise man elderly man now. He studied back in the 1940s and 1950s the Senoi, this tribe in Malaysia, and wrote a book about it. And he once made the comment, Louise and I flew out to Hawaiians on a couple of occasions to interview him, and he once made the comment to me that about the tyranny of choice. And he made the exact same comment that you're making, that, you know, people very often in Aboriginal Indigenous societies don't have a lot of choices, and they actually prefer it that way.
Yeah, well, what's like in Ithaca here, there are a lot of these, like, Tibetan monks around,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have a whole lot of choices in their life, but they seem pretty darn happy, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's a very interesting one. Charles, thanks for bringing that up, The Tyranny of Choice. I had forgotten about that. I'm going to have to track down the title of the new title of Robert's book. Jennifer in Berkeley, California. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Hey.
I started brushing my teeth while I was on hold.
Oh.
Gargle
and spit quick. What's up?
No. I'm also at a little bit of a disadvantage because I had to, like, get my question vetted while you were saying, I think, some very important things. But I called initially to say I was very interested and would have liked to hear more of the argument of that guy with the book. And I kind of wanted to say to you, Tom, don't be so defensive. I'm extremely progressive and liberal, and I'm extremely unhappy. I don't think those two things are incongruent, I don't think that they don't match each other. It's not a moral statement or disparagement of progressive values who chooses what they believe in based on the emotional returns it's going to give them. I don't think people choose to believe what they believe. I think that they believe it based on, their frame that they're born with and brought up with and the truth that they see. And I think that it's very important and helpful that more people become progressive because they see the truth and learn different things and become more uncomfortable with inequality, from segregation being lifted and getting to know their fellow human being. And I think that raising a sense of justice in people is going to make them unhappy with a status quo if it enforces injustice.
Yeah, well, in fact, Thomas Jefferson's thoughts on happiness. He said happiness, this is he writing in his autobiography, he said happiness comes of the capacity to feel deeply, to enjoy simply, to think freely, to risk life, to be needed, which gives happiness. And then William James, who, the American philosopher and psychologist who died in 1910, he said, we never enjoy perfect happiness. Our most fortunate successes are mingled with sadness. Some anxieties always perplex the reality of our satisfaction. So, the essence of his book and he's, on all the conservative talk shows now, promoting this, is conservatives are happier, therefore become a conservative. And,
see,
like you, Jennifer.
Problem. It's the second step that's the problem. It's therefore take soma that's the problem with that philosophy. It's perfectly understandable that we would be less happy. It's not just that we have to, and it's a lot of things that you were saying. We're trying to work for a better world, which is overwhelming and difficult, and also we're living in that kind of sucky world where a lot of, frankly, choices are taken away from us. I understand the thing about having too many choices. That makes sense also, but we also, if we've made a choice and we don't have to want to make other choices, a lot of times maybe that career path or whatever it is we know we could be good at has been taken away from us and we don't have an opportunity to give to society and the world what we know that we can give. And I think that's got to be profound depression for a lot of people.
Yeah, well said, Jennifer. Thank you very much for the call. The book by Robert Wolf, by the way, is now called Original Wisdom. And thank you, Sean, for that. And Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Along that same vein about happiness, I came across the thought, it wasn't my thought, but I came across it a while back, that the most important quality in marriage was not necessarily happiness, but stability.
Well, again, so we get to this, how do you define happiness? Because I think a lot of people would say stability is happiness.
I think that's how you define it. And maybe the analogy is, do we have stability in our democracy? Do we have stability in the direction of our culture and our country at this point in time?
Yeah,
I think
there
could be an analogy there.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well said, Gary. Thank you. Peter in Homestead, Florida. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to probably talk about, I don't know why conservatives tend to think they have a stronghold or whatever on hard work and perseverance like liberals.
They don't. What his study found was that conservatives were more likely to say if somebody is successful, it is the result of hard work. And liberals are more likely to say if somebody is successful, there are variables beyond hard work. That if somebody is born poor and black in the ghetto, they can work their ass off their whole lives and they're never going to make as much money as somebody who is born as the son of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Precisely, exactly. And I wanted to know if you'd allow me to read a small quote from Helen Keller. I got it from the book Lies of Teacher Told Me.
Yeah, generally we don't do reading on the show here, but if you want to just give me the essence of it, Peter, that would be fine. We have 40 seconds, by the way, before the music is going to start.
Basically, saying a originally she believed that just through simply hard work and perseverance you can make it. But as she went through her lives and she went through these mills and worker strikes, she realized that the power to rise in the world is not in the reach of everyone, because a lot of it has to do with luck, where you were born, things that you didn't earn.
Right, who your parents are, where, yeah, exactly, where physically you were born, not just even the town that you were born, but the part of town that you were born into.
Yeah.
You know, the absolutely, beyond a doubt. And this is the thing where, you know, conservatives are more likely to say, yes, it's hard to wait. And again, in the book, he's holding this up like it's some kind of high value to say, hey, conservatives say that, you know, hard work and perseverance is correlated with income. Well, yeah, most people would like to hold to that ideal. But liberals are more likely to understand the reality that as I said, if you're born in the ghetto, your outcome is in all probability going to be different than if you're born as the son of a Walker or a Bush. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And we have a winner in our contest for the best post on our blog today, on the Daily Show blog at TomHartman.com. And Sean Taylor, our producer, has the result. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. This one relates to happiness and who has it, and hopefully our winner does after this. It's from Cheryl, who says, defining happiness is as individual as we each are. It's not a question that can actually be answered in the broad spectrum. For myself, the more I simplify my life, rather, the happier or more joyful I feel. I'm a far-left, bleeding-heart, liberal, socialist, and I am absolutely joyful.
Hey, well done. So, and she gets a copy of, an autographed copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Tom.
And thanks to our poster. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Scott in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, that blog post just kind of stole my thunder.
That's great.
I was just...
Great minds think alike.
I was just calling to say, you know, it all depends on how you define success, and we in America tend to define success on how much money we have and how big our house is and what kind of car we drive.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a stay-at-home dad with two boys, and my wife's a school teacher, and, you know, I consider myself hugely successful. And, you know, we have a small 850-square-foot house, and we have what we need. And,
yeah. There's an old cliche about happiness, you know, success being, I don't even remember the, you know, it's like one of those things that you'd see on posters back 20 years ago. But success is being happy with what you have as opposed to having what you're not, you know, not what you want.
I need, and everything I need is enough.
There you go. Perfect. Perfect. Scott, thank you very much. Very well said. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Called about climate change, but I want to say about happiness. I think a lot of what we call happiness is actually suppression of discomfort rather than a transcendence of negativity, you know, the freedom.
Hmm.
It's a dramatically different as saying like when you and love. And I like Aldous Huxley's quote, ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you mad.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. It's like if you're banging your head with a hammer all day long and then you stop, all of a sudden you feel good.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with Dale about the forest thing. It's amazing. I traveled hundreds of miles through Michigan, Wisconsin last summer, and also through Quintana Roo, Mexico, and Yucatan.
Mm.
And the entire time, I only counted, you know, in the single digits, miles of virgin forest.
Right.
And it's amazingly different than any forest you ever see. It's like a cathedral. It's like comparing the Hagia Sophia, you know, in Turkey to a rundown house trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the noticeable things when you go to these, you know, the jungle or the forest, is it's cool in there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, like, say, John Stossel, say, hey, we have as much forest as we used to have, or perhaps even more. It's not, it's also the depth of the forest. It's the entire biomass that's important.
Yeah, it's qualitatively different and
yeah,
massively qualitatively
different.
Yeah, we may
be changing albedo with the planet, the reflectivity of the sunlight off the planet by the types of forest we have, just as, like, also this fallow farmland has also changed the albedo because you've got the dark soil as opposed to the plants.
Right. It also drives evaporation. You know, most evaporation that happens, most of the cycling of water is actually through the leaves of trees. And one tree is equal to, I think, 40 square acres of water in terms of its ability to evaporate water into the atmosphere, because the leaves, both the upper and lower surface of the leaves, are constantly ducting moisture out into the air at a very, very high rate, particularly when the sun is out, whereas water surfaces are really more like desert. I mean, water doesn't, frankly, evaporate all that well off an ocean. It takes thousands of miles of ocean to create that kind of evaporative surface that a couple hundred square miles of rainforest or jungle will do.
Yeah, and so, we also need that for retaining the groundwater, keep it from running down quickly and causing erosion.
Right, the trees draw it down. That's right.
And
they draw it down deeply into the soil so that they can then cycle it back up through the leaves.
Yes.
Excellent point. Thank you very much, Jeff. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening there in Denver. David in Woodstock, Connecticut. Hey, David.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm fine. Listen, I've been fascinated by this discussion of happiness, and I think you're absolutely right that we need to define what happiness means. Happiness is one of those words like God, you know, people use it all the time without checking to see whether everyone else agrees with their own meaning of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if I ask someone, are you happy? And he says, yes, we don't know what he is. We don't know what he's feeling. All we know is that he calls it happiness.
Right.
And so when you ask that in a survey and you find out that a certain number of people are happy because of a political philosophy, we don't know whether one causes the other or vice versa, or whether they're both caused by something else, or whether they're the coincidence.
Right.
One doesn't cause the other at all.
Yeah, and
because we don't know what they mean.
Right, and where it becomes really crass, and well said, David, and thank you very much. Where it becomes really crass, then, is when you get right-wing talk show hosts saying, see, you want to be happy? Become a conservative, because the conservatives are happier. And, you know, vote against your own economic self-interest, and vote to destroy the planet, and what? John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, about a half a minute before we got to wrap up this show.
Oh boy. I'm discontent, dissatisfied, and ignorant. And that last that one author you talk about limited choices being happy, leading to happiness, sounds like an extrapolation of ignorance is bliss. It is not human.
It could be. On the other hand, do you think that the people who are given 40 choices of which insurance company do you want for Part B of Medicare are happier than if they had been given 3 choices?
Oh, that's just a bunch of white noise.
What do you mean?
White noise for thinking. It's people's choices they think about rather than what's thrown in on their head.
Right, okay. All righty. John, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNS News, about the Virginia primary results, and we'll be seeing what happened, plus John McCain's proposed tax cuts and climate change strategy, plus sex worker Audacia Ray joins me in talking about legalizing, regulating, and protecting the sex worker industry, and, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.